This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
A preface for the assembly from Pema Chodron. And when things fall apart. To be fully alive, fully human, and completely awake is to be continually thrown out of the nest. To live fully is to always be in no man's land, to experience each moment as completely new and fresh. To live is to be willing to die over and over again. Enlightenment poem. By Chiyoni. In this way and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. Since the bamboo strip was weakening, about to break, then the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. This poem, I realized I had, there's a famous woodblock of Chiyoni with her bucket, and this poem, which I had cut out many years ago, not realizing that she would come back and visit today. And I wanted to explore breaking open, keeping it together, and falling apart. Who is it that keeps it together? Who is it that falls apart? How do we understand the self? And part of this is coming out of recently, I've been, not just recently, like over the past three years or so, with my own big breakage, I've been breaking so many things. I mean, it's like, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to touch it because I'm just breaking. Most significantly, I had a tea bowl from Rengetsu from the late 1800s, which I was going to share at a dinner with my lady friends, and I picked up the box with one hand and ba-dum, 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 plunk, it went and shattered. And that's pottery, I know it. It breaks. But this was Rengetsu's piece from the 1800s. It was broken. I quickly glued it because I couldn't stand the thought, and I put it back in the box, and I haven't looked at it since. I did the clay retreat recently, and I brought over 5 bowls of my primos of raku that I really loved, didn't give away. And to show, you know, the folks in the retreat the potential of raku. And the retreat was finished. I packed them up. I was at cabin 10. And, usually I pack things really well, but I was only going from cabin 10 to my A-frame. I can carry the bag there pretty well, I thought. So I just put a piece of newspaper in between the 5 of them, put them in a plastic bag, and I got ready to go. I grabbed the bag, and the handle broke, and I heard that horrible sound. Pink. I was like, oh, no, which one is it? All 5. Like dominoes, all 5. I kept looking again and again in disbelief that all 5 had been taken out. I just left the bag there. Usually I bring them home just to look at, and I put it away. I went home, and there's this feeling inside, like you can't, it's fragile, and like you can't get it back. It's done. And it's a weird feeling. So, and then there were other things, lanterns, light bulbs. My attendant has a mantra now, which is, I'll get the vacuum. It's okay. I'll get the vacuum. And so I was looking at, wow, what is this? Like, not to analyze, but, and there was something I can't describe in it, which was also very freeing, that there was a tightness that I had around me in handling my life and looking at things, compartmentalizing myself, and somehow these breakages were hitting something in me that was already falling apart and needed to go further. We've been talking about this disruption, rupturing, inconvenienced by the truth, life interrupted, whatever you want to call it, when we're pushed out of that nest, when that centralizing, that cozy centralizing into ourselves is busted. So, and then I remembered it when we had these way-seeking mind talks in the SZBA, that it was a T-ball that brought me to Buddhism, that brought me to Zen, that my first teacher in clay was very formal in pottery. Everything was measured and the foot had to be in proportions. And then I saw this, I got in my hands a T-ball that was deeply centered, like so centered. I could feel it, but it was asymmetrical and it was repaired. Like somebody cared enough to repair it and bring it to this other birth, this other beauty. And I remember when I felt that, in my mind I went, who let this happen? I have to know, who let this happen? So that sent me to find Rangetsu and her practice as a Buddhist nun, and it went on. It's when we lose the illusion of control, when we're most vulnerable and exposed, that we can discover this creative potential of our lives. I love what James Baldwin writes about the creative process and the artist. He writes, "The moral responsibility of the artist is someone who helps you see reality again." That's why they're often called the shamans in the culture. They help you see reality again. He says, in the artist's struggle for integrity, the artist has to make real for themselves the fact that the birth of a child is holy. The birth of a child is holy. That's bringing a creation into the world. In it, he says, we need to say what it is like to be alive. Between this sky and this earth, we break open our hearts to say, what does it feel like to be here? Chiyoni is telling us her state. And Pema Chodron, also in the Wisdom of No Escape, which I love, she says, she has a chapter on inconvenience. She says, when you hear some teaching that rings true to you and you feel some trust in practicing the way and some trust in it being a worthwhile way to live, then you're in for a lot of inconvenience. So from an everyday perspective, it seems kind of good that things are kind of convenient. There's no problem with this. But when we take the path of the Buddha Dharma, how true this really is. When we start to want to live our lives fully, turn towards practice, towards Zazen in particular, feel a passion for life and growth, dying to our solid sense of who we are, You know, we hear, may we be free from self-clinging, and we're like, yes, until it happens. When we follow our heart, we're going to meet inconvenience. So what can of kind of wisdom can be drawn from such a statement as hers, given our strong propensity for comfort, entitlement, shortcuts, reactivity? Chioni, when she was ordained, is Mugai Nyodai. And she's in our on our altar, one of the photographs next to the one that looks like Kaijun on the left. And here's there's sketchy history, so I went to a couple sources. So here's a little bit about her life. She what happened to her life here? Whoops. Somewhere is her life. Okay. Somewhere slipped away. She was born in 1223 and died in 1298. Dogen was born in 1200. So he was 23 when she was born, but she was in a Rinzai sect. And when she was, hold on, let me just look for that a second. That's what happens with cut and paste. Okay. And she was born and was very, to an aristocratic family, and she was very well trained in Japanese and Chinese. And she actually went to, she married at the age of 23. It was an arranged marriage, and it was believed that she had a daughter. She went to work as a servant in a convent. And she became interested in, she had a difficult life, but she came across the teachings of Buddhism and began to go to some of the monasteries that were around her. And at every one that she went to, she would ask, what is Zen? So she went to where she met her teacher, who was a Rinzai teacher. His name was Wushu. And at that time, he was been raised in China, and he could have been criticized for speaking alone to a woman in a room, but because that violated the eight rules. But according to the Bodhisattva precepts, which said anyone who's demanding the Dharma, you need to address that. So that's the one he went with. It was said, it's coming back to me now, that Chioni was quite beautiful, Chiono, really beautiful, and that the emperor and some of the priests were very annoying to her. She couldn't do her work. She couldn't practice because of her beauty. It got in the way. And she rejected all their advances. She just wanted to practice the Dharma. But it was very difficult for her. It's said that what she did was then took an iron to her face and burned it and remained scarred for the rest of her life. And when she turned up to Master Wushu, he couldn't tell if he was meeting a man or a woman until she spoke, and he could feel it. So he didn't hesitate to meet her. And she asked him, he said, how can I help you? He had some tea prepared. And she said, what is Zen? And he just answered, holding her in his eyes. And he said, Zen is the heart of the one who asks, not someone else's words. She smiled and she said, so why does the teacher give sermons that are recorded? He smiled back and he said, with a deaf man, you show him the moon by pointing. With a blind man, you show him the gate by knocking on it. And after a long pause, almost as an afterthought, he said, when I was awakened, it was like a bird escaping from a cage. So she continued to go back to him. She liked him. She had still her beautiful hair. And one day, she sent a maidservant away, and she cut her hair, and she started visiting him and practicing there and asked for ordination. She felt very alone. There was a long grief from losing her parents, her husband, her youth. She thought she'd known about love, wisdom, and death when she was a young woman. And that had been a long time before, and she knew a lot less now. And women who were convicted of certain crimes had their heads shaved in punishment. And without hair, one's sex disappeared, in a sense. Their status, their clan, their identity, their class, their age. So she took a big risk for what she knew was true in her heart. So she asked, after a time, she asked for ordination and practiced at Engakuji, which is a Rinzai temple. And ordained, she became Mugai Nyodai. And she practiced along with the monks, rose just like we do every day before dawn for hours of silent meditation in the dark zendo. She liked to recite the sutras over and over again, and they really sank into her marrow, sank past the sting of unattended ego and the lance of loss. Each morning they ate breakfast in the zendo, small plops of rice gruel by the ladleful in small black bowls. Sound familiar? She mopped, swept, did work practice, kept her head wrapped in a cloth. And the monk in charge gave her an old lacquer bucket and told her to fetch water from the river. It was good novice work, and it was an hour's walk each way, guaranteeing that she would be out of his hair for most of the day, because he felt uncomfortable with her there, it said. Each day, after breakfast, she picked up her bucket. Its bamboo braces were weak and loose, and it often leaked. So she spent hours trying to repair the braces. She felt like the bucket leaked, just like her life leaked, dripping out. Day by day, she wrapped the bucket in new strips of bamboo, tightening the staves, and hoping at the same time to fix her broken life. And she watched. She knelt by the stream and watched the water enter her bucket drop by drop, and she saw it was part of the ocean, part of the rain, part of the dew, part of the icicles, part of the steam, part of the clouds, all the same water in the as the water in her bucket. She knew the world vibrated with life, and she longed for that immensity to really touch her. But she felt a kind of hollowness. Which drop fills the bucket? All of them. Which leak empties the bucket? All of them. Which one matters most? All of them. And one day she was sitting with Wu Shu when they heard a deer cry in the forest. And he said, "Where is the deer? Do you know who hears it?" And then he shouted so loud that it broke something in her. Something broke in her at that moment. And so she went off and she wrote a second poem. She saw the moon reflecting equally in everything, the whole moon reflected in a single drop hanging from a leaf. And she carried the water back, gave it to the cook, bowed, and went to her room where she wrote a poem. The bucket took the stream water and held it, and the reflection of the moon through the pines lodged there in purity. And next day she showed it to her teacher, and he said, "It's a good start. Now go away and read the Heart Sutra. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness, exactly form." In the Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, Shariputra talks about the realization of emptiness, the truth of things, that ultimately nothing is fixed, nothing can be grasped, nothing can be possessed. You can't take it with you is true right now. And Shariputra says, if when this is pointed out to a student of the way, to a bodhisattva, if their heart does not become cowed, does not despair or become despondent, if they turn away or become dejected, don't tremble, if they are not frightened or terrified, then this person, this student of the way, should be given instructions. It is precisely this that should be recognized as the wisdom of the Buddha. And I think it was mentioned in yesterday's talk, at this moment, seeking what is true has to be more important than having our own desires and beliefs affirmed. And to do this, we have to summon courage, patience, to face things as they are, not how we want them to be. She stopped and practiced one act, the seamlessness of the mind of Zazen. She stopped wishing to work in the kitchen. She stopped wishing not to grieve. She stopped longing to understand. She just went and got water from the stream, kept filling her bucket. One act, the act of going on. One hot evening when the moon was full, she walked dreamily along the path. She was alone with the crickets. When she bent to scoop water into her bucket, its bottom fell out. Neodai's water spilled over the ground. It disappeared into the soil, melted into the grass, invisible and vast. Who hears the deer? Who carries the water? Who grieves? Who learns? The next morning, her teacher passed her and saw her face lit up like the moon and asked her to come to his room. And she stood before him and said, "I have a new poem." This is another translation of the one I read. "So many ways I fix the bucket, its braces weak and soon to break, until one day the bottom fell out. Then there was no water in the bucket, no moon shining in the water." Eventually, Wushu gave her the priest's gold robe of golden white brocade with a ring made of tortoiseshell. And she was made the first female Zen master in Japan. So the very first time we receive instruction in Zazen, we're exposed to a profound teaching of letting go of the judging mind. That in that disruption, the inconvenience to not live and see the world based on what we want the world to be, but to see the world as it is. We all hold pictures of our ideal self in an ideal world. And we imagine that if we could only manipulate our circumstances or other people enough, then that ideal me could be achieved. And in the meantime, we try and pretend that we have it all together. And this game we play all the time. We keep postponing our acceptance of this moment in order to pursue a reality that we think is how it should be. And when we really get disrupted, what we find is that we really can't play the game anymore. That's the disruption. As hard as we try, we just can't play it anymore, and it's such a dissonance from the old way. Then the breaking moment happens, perhaps, where we trust the makeup of the present moment without adding, judging, just directly encounter our lives, a direct experience recognized as the wisdom of the Buddha. And in order to do this well, we have to keep learning how to turn towards what is true. And that can take our lifetime, years and years of mindfulness, trusting, failing, flailing in unknown land. Because we know now is very uncertain. That's certain. That's why it's so powerful if we can actually be in it. Reality is uncertain, and our ideas are where we want to be certain. So the instructions are given not only how to turn, but what to do when we meet it. Chioni meditated and practiced for many years without attaining enlightenment and became very discouraged in her practice. But now we know her as a great teacher, a great ancestor, that she did take up this difficult task of turning towards obstacles, gaining insight, releasing her grip. In this way and that, I tried and tried to keep the bucket together. We become habitually confused and lose confidence in our wisdom mind, which we all have. That's what these ancestors do know about us, because they know it in themselves, that we're never apart from that. Our compassion, our wisdom. And I found a few very helpful descriptions of some very familiar ways we try to avoid what is happening. Like, the Buddha didn't miss a trick. How, when we're on the brink of falling apart and we do not know what will happen, or we're not in what is happening the moment, we will try these strategies to keep it together. And then how we can turn towards our obstacles. And it is consistently amazing to me how we can have so many teachings, like a banquet, like food just laid out so beautifully on a plate. We know it, we see it, we hear it, and we don't pick it up and eat it. We look at it. I know, but that other way is just so compelling. It's like, I think of this moment where my tent pole broke, and I had the piece 5 feet away in my pack to fix it. But I just stood there, and I was just like, oh my God, it's broken. Oh my God, it's broken. Oh my God, it's broken. And you wouldn't believe how long it took me to go get the piece to slide it on and fix it. I had a discussion with another woman. I said, I have the piece in my pack. But I never just got it and put it on. It took a while. And I feel like that sometimes. Now I see, like, I know what I can do, but I don't do it. It's so weird. Any obstacle we meet has the power to pop the bubble of reality that we have come to regard as secure and certain. When we're threatened like this, we can't stand to feel the edginess, the anxiety, the heat of the anger that's arising. So we reach for whatever we think will blot it out. We try to grasp for something pleasant. The way to turn that into that is to open our hearts and look at how we try to escape. We can use pleasure seeking as an opportunity to observe what we do in the face of pain. Do you notice how quickly we try to recreate ourselves when things fall apart? We turn to the solid ground of a self-concept as quickly as possible. And I think Trungpa called this nostalgia for samsara. We miss it. When things fall apart, instead of struggling to regain our concept of who we are, can we take the opportunity to be inquisitive and wonder? Wonder about what just happened and what will happen next. That's how we can turn towards this. When we feel strong emotions, instead of letting feelings be, we weave them into a story, a storyline, which give rise to even bigger emotions. We all use emotions to regain our ground when things fall apart. It's a very subtle thing. There's first feeling it, like when they're just coming, and then there's bringing it in again and again and again, because it's a familiar thing to live in, possibly in that emotion, even though it might be a very difficult feeling. Do you notice how we go for it because we know it so well, and who would we be without it? We can turn this by using heavy emotion as a way to develop true compassion for ourselves. Do we ever turn that way? Do we ever feel for ourselves? May I be at peace? May I not suffer? Oh, honey. Oh, that's a tough one. Yeah. Say yes. Noticing the fear of death when we kill the moment by controlling our experience. We want to hold on to what we have. We want to every experience to confirm us and congratulate us and make us feel completely together. We say fear of death, but maybe it's actually fear of life. We can turn this by using the desire to control as a reminder to experience each moment new and fresh. We can always return to basic wisdom mind. When there is something radical that breaks us open, when reality as we know it comes apart, that there's that big hit in who I am-ness. I call it I merged an initiation with death, so it's a death initiation, a definition being busted. When Yukon and I were with our friend Janet McCarris in her last days, right in front of us was the reminder of how we relinquish control over our own bodily functions to strangers. Holding it all together there was not an option. There are times like these we may each have experienced in our lives, such as facing death or even birth, when we're no longer able to manage our outer image, no longer able to be in pursuit of that ideal self. It's just how it is. We're human beings. And in these times of crisis, we just don't have the energy to hold it together. Sometimes it takes that to open us up. When things fall apart, we can only be who we are. Pretense and striving often fall away, and life becomes really stark and simple. These are valuable moments. We are shown that the game can be given up, and that is when the emptiness we feared, emptiness of the void, is not what is there. What is there is the bare fact of being. Simple presence remains. Breathing in, breathing out, waking up and going to sleep, our complexity ceases. Our compulsive manufacturing stops. And perhaps in these very ungrounded, in this ungrounded space, we're not even comforting ourselves, not even telling ourselves everything's going to be okay. I know when I was in the depths of that, there was no way I could say to myself, everything's going to be okay. I had no idea what that even meant. What is okay? Why isn't this okay? What I was experiencing in that moment. Still looking for the ideal, okayness to happen. When this is done, I'm going to be okay. When I get over this, I'm going to be okay. What about now? What about now, as you are? Sometimes we're forced into non-grasping. What remains when we can be in that is a new moment spontaneously meeting us again and again and again, just like that. To know this ground and become familiar with it, we can relax into the inherent peacefulness of not knowing what's going to come next. That's being in the reality of the uncertainty of now. I thought of it's like one of those snow globes. I don't know if you ever had one. I used to collect them. You know, you shake them up. And there's something there in the center, but it's hidden as long as it's being shook up. But once it's left to settle and it gets steady on the surface, then we can see what we're supposed to see. What's meant to be seen will be revealed. There will be a response. Pema said, if you're interested in these teachings, then you have to accept the fact that you're never going to get it all together. We're never going to get our act together fully or completely. We're always going to be in a position where we don't know. She says, what would this possibly look like to get it all together? We're always in a position where something more can happen to us. In this way and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. Since the bamboo strip was weakening, about to break, then the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. And when it fell apart, Chiona used her circumstances knowingly. In that moment, she realized, perhaps, that all her ideas about herself and reality were nothing but false reflections, like that moon being held together by a bucket, being held together by our delusions, and she released. And said she just continued to fetch water. Life went on. I think our liberation depends on that refinement of that capacity to be in that flexibility and that discernment, to fall apart and to keep it together. That we discover and exercise the freedom of mind to keep things together or let things come apart in accord with circumstances. So I took these bowls, and there's a technique in Japan called kintsugi, an ancient technique, which means golden joinery. It's the practice of mending pots by filling them with adhesive resin mixed with gold dust. So I went back to the bowls, and I was moved to rejoin them. I happen to have some gold dust laying around. Don't we all? So I mixed it in the epoxy, And I started to join them back together. It was such an it is such an emotional feeling to do this. I can't say exactly what it is. I noticed too how I've been painting lately is at the very last minute I'll throw something in to break up what I know, like a mark I would never ever make, and I have to deal. And this was coming, this has been coming up again and again. It's just, and this felt like that. And so I started to take other bowls and mix them in. So now it's not just the one that broke, but other pots have joined it. Shards from Japan that I found have joined it. So it's coming into this whole new birth. There was an essay written on this tradition of mending, which was seen as a physical embodiment of the spirit of Mushin, or no mind. She wrote, "This state is associated with fully existing within the moment, non-attachment, equanimity, amid changing conditions, and relinquishing the impulse to impose one's will on the world. Accidental fractures set in motion acts of repair that accept given circumstances and work within them to lead to an ultimately more profound appearance. The only willfulness in the process is the effort to assist with the rebirth of something whose existence has been threatened, something that has held virtue, held value for others. The meeting of acceptance and care in turn evokes what they call mano no awari, the pathos of things, a compassionate sensitivity, an empathy, an identification with transient things, appreciating things are temporary, fragile, and that we are vulnerable to gradual or sudden changes, to the breakup of the body. So whether it's a mended bowl, a kneecap, we care for it. It was knowing how to care for things that she kept repairing the bucket. And in the Shingi, the rules of monastic living, the Dogen even spoke about the workmaster was in charge of repairing broken things to the best of their ability to try and fix and use what has been broken. It is a shifting ground. This is from Pema Chandro. It is a shifting ground because compassionate responsiveness is not static. We never step into the same river twice. But this doesn't mean there is nothing. It isn't that there is something there either, but it's not nothing. Longchepa calls it the self-originating clear light and says that in this light, what appears is neither concretized nor latched onto, because what appears never becomes what it seems to be and is intrinsically free. You see, it's not just another construct. It's the ground that doesn't need to be contrived or maintained. It's experience itself. I'll end with, if I have it, jeez, I don't know what happened here. See? Everything's breaking apart. Okay. Anyway. that.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.